Okay, it's my belief that it's now recording.
It is on audio.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I think so.
Does that mean I should stop?
I think so. You have those five, five chords here hanging about. Is it supposed to come? Yeah, I think like that.
Welcome. It's time for us to begin, I think. Tonight we have another evening with breaks in painting. And we're going to, let's see, do I need to do any business? Business. All right, I'm getting from you. I am getting from you this week your little emails about your the paper topics. And I think, let's see, the many of you I've gotten, and I think that some of you I still haven't heard from. And I may have given you some initial reaction and maybe even more. In any case, if they're still coming, let me get them this week. And text for, we have. Relative next week, if I'm not mistaken, those texts are up, or the places to get them are up, and the readings for that evening. I'm not sure if I come after that. Anyway, we do have coming up an evening on Mugliere, and there are two plays that they're doing by him, and those are up in multiple forms. That is to say, there's a translation I've gotten. Put it, you can go online to it if you want to see it there, but also it's been put into documented into RTF form. And I may have done that fancy things, I don't quite recall. Anyway, I don't have any factology up about the Mugliere, but you can look up anything you like on your own, I may put something up. Right, after that, let's see. Oh, I must remind you, urge you, I've told you this before, but you are on your own getting a copy of the which will be here not on April the something. April.
Yes. And I would ask you to please do get a hard copy. There are copies available online, of course, but we're not going to have the same text because there are multiple translations, and B, we are going to discuss it. We are going to be including the text in class, so please have a hard copy and bring it to class.
Of what?
Catalan.
Okay.
Some of your
Did you want a proposition, you said? I didn't know you wanted one. Emailing one?
Yeah, email.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, I think that is fine. Tonight, we are happy to have with us Professor Laura Eit, who is in the Modern Languages Department, German Program, Spanish Complet. Her degree is in Comparative Literature, but with an emphasis on art history. And this is one of the areas that she knows a great deal about, and we will hear her with great interest.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for coming on such a beautiful evening. But it would probably be a lot nicer to sit outside with a cool view. So I appreciate you coming here. We'll hopefully have an entertaining evening with art instead. I would like to actually start by asking you, because you already watched or saw a couple of these images online, hopefully, in a lot more clarity than they are presented here. So I would like to just start off by asking you what about the differences we had. We have three paintings here on very similar topics. They're all representations of a bankruptcy. That first that was very popular in that book.
I need to plug this in.
So what kind of differences did you notice? What would you say? How would you interpret the differences?
Color, the darkness and light, especially with the some of the like the focus, some of them are, especially the one on the left corner, it's really everything's kind of close together. Mm-hmm. And then Rembrandt's, he uses a big open space for the display of the people marching out. You don't know if they're going to a battle or war necessarily. And it's different from that makes that a big difference from those two where they're
the space in the first one, which is also the earliest one, is a lot more cramped, and people are a lot more crowded and a lot more stiff.
Noticed in Rembrandt's that the man who's wearing the gloves in the first painting has one of his gloves off, almost as if he's ready to get in the midst of whatever's going on. It just seems like there's much more action
right.
happening But the main man is not looking at her, mm-hmm. which I found interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have a lot more light, dark contrast in that painting, and like you also said, a lot more movement and action. And especially in the first painting, there's no action whatsoever. In the second one, there is a lot, little more, but it's still a very static representation. Mm-hmm. Any other?
Similar. That one seems like their faces in that are very similar on the top left.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Yeah, they all look like variations on one person, but they're not very individualized. It's much more, much more similarity. Whereas in the other two, and especially the Mama, there's a lot more individualized, personalized faces.
And mm-hmm. between the top and the bottom, the use of the bottom one's more warmer looking with the yellow and the reds mm-hmm. are kind of more dominant. Mm-hmm. That, the top one so much more of the black and white kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they stand out mm-hmm. whatever their color.
And who they're looking at is different also. In the top painting, even the man with the gloves, mm-hmm. and I'm assuming he's very important because he seems more formal or something, mm-hmm. I don't know, is looking at the man to his right wearing mm-hmm. the black hat. Mm-hmm. And everyone else almost, or several of them, are looking off, past over to the left. Mm-hmm. And a similar thing is happening in the middle painting. Mm-hmm. But over there to the right, everybody seems to be doing they're very busy doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. They're tending to their own business mm-hmm. more so. And I know it's really hard to see because the depiction right now is so dark. But.
Yeah, but one thing about, here, especially those two paintings, like you said, but I think there's also, they're kind of looking like you don't really know what they're looking at. They're looking kind of into space. They're not, some of them are forward looking at each other or away from each other, but there's really, they're looking, but you don't really know what they're looking at. There's really no clear interaction between them. And that is a little bit more integrated in this one, but it just makes it, you're just wondering what are they looking at. They're obviously gathered there together, but there's no interaction between the people. And in this one, you're right, we still have distinctive groups, and they're all busy doing something, but they're doing something, so they don't really need to be looking at each other, facing each other. So it makes a little more sense in that way. To focus your vision to make you look at something. The other pictures, it's not really that clear what is the most important part or where you should look first or how you should look at the picture.
It seems like with Harlan, is that
Harlan? Yeah. You're referring to this here?
No, I'm sorry, the one that we have talked
about. Oh, okay.
On the left. It's not the focal point, but it is one, and that all the men are sort of surrounded by a representation of their colors. Mm-hmm. But then in the next one at the bottom, it's almost more realistic because they look like men really kind of mm-hmm. having fun or engaged in something. Yeah. But then you kind of lose the focus, it seems, of the color or what they are.
there, they have their own campaign space. But yeah, very good. Yeah, so we can almost really see the progression from a very stiff. I'm not saying that this is a bad painting at all. And it was actually very, very advanced for its time. And he has an earlier one that is on the same topic. And this is quite advanced from that too. You know, so people are a lot more, the representation is a lot better. But we can see that there's definitely a progression toward more movement, toward more. Here we have kind of a very rigid representation here. Everything is much more, and the lines, for example, we have a much more of a diagonal movement, which is very typical for Baroque art. There's a lot more diagonal or triangular lines or spaces. And we're going to talk about the night watch later on tonight. So this is all that I wanted to say about this. Three paintings for now. Now, how do I get to my PowerPoint?
But I can sit here and you can tell me.
Would
you like this bigger?
If it gets any bigger, that
well, I mean, don't you in your PowerPoint things, don't you have this to make it like the whole screen?
I'm sure there is. Oh,
Okay, outlines. Sure. No, this is.
There should be a way to do a slideshow.
Slide only. I like that. Well, no, that's no good.
Yeah.
I'll figure this out.
Okay, well, never let's get started. Okay, so we've already mentioned a couple of features of Baroque art, such as,
Movement? Mm-hmm. Display of act, like the action actually taking place, mm-hmm. not, like prior, you know, you're getting ready to do something.
Very good. Movement, action.
Lines.
Diagonal.
Kind of plain line dark.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very good. And that is called what? Yeah, that's cool. Very good. And Rembrandt is a very is one of the masters of that. He is really very famous for this play with light and dark and shadows. And it would be nice if the pictures could be seen better, but anyway, so we have chiaroscuro, the triangular composition, and the drama. And some of the ways in which this is represented is using what is called the concettismo, that is kind of a way of a focusing on image and metaphorical representation. It is taking, this term is taken from literature. And in the Baroque period, there's a lot of interaction between word and image, a lot of connection. So if the writing is very rhetorical, so are the images. They're trying to be very rhetorical, trying to convince the viewer of something. They are really, there is a very close connection between word and image this time. And then Meraviglia and Spectacle, they both refer to kind of the Baroque attempt to create a drama. So Meraviglia, what do you think that means? Yeah, so they're interested in the marvelous and the and spectacle and the spectacular. And Rembrandt's painting of, could we move one slide forward because I have a figure on the next one. This is the Blinding of Samson, and here we can see this interest in the spectacle and the marvelous and the even in the horrible. He has chosen what is the story of Samson? What happened?
Gives a secret away of the strength, which is his hair.
Mm-hmm.
And they cut his, when they blind him, cut his hair off, mm-hmm. and then ultimately, at the end, his hair starts to grow back, and he dies being crushed, holding the pillars up as mm-hmm. he is defeating Satan.
So that Rembrandt has here chosen kind of the gruesome climax of the story, the exact time where his eyes are being stabbed, and in the background we can't see that here, but there are the soldiers who are holding him. They're holding him, and one is actually at this moment is stabbing out one eye. And you can see the blood splattering, and then the other one is getting ready to stab the other eye. So he has chosen that exact moment. Now, this story has been represented millions of times, but nobody really ever chose this exact moment. They chose the moment when he got captured or some other moment, but this particular moment, this exact moment of the stabbing of his eye, is really a very innovative representation. And then the way he represents it, too, with the light falling exactly just on that area, and everything else is kind of dark. And then we can't see any of that, but the faces of the soldiers are very important to it. Look, they're horrified, but they're still doing it. But you can also see the horror in their faces. So this is this is a very topic of high interest to the world. The people they wanted to see things like that. They wanted to see the gruesome, the horrible, marvelous, spectacular. Things like that were very popular. Now this is kind of a phase. Rembrandt didn't do this throughout his whole career. He's depicted other versions of someone of his life that are much more calm and mellow in the later episodes. So this is kind of not something that he did throughout his career. But that's good. Yes, that's good. Okay, you also looked at these two images. We're still trying to define exactly the nature of Baroque art, and especially here now in contrast to older art, Renaissance art. What we have again the same topic, the Annunciation, in both paintings. How can we say that it's represented differently?
Well, there's more detail. Especially one of the big differences is the linear perspective and the focal point. That you're in the Renaissance, when your eyes are always, they always seem to go to Mary.
Mm-hmm.
It seems always to be drawn, like everything in the picture. Especially
mm-hmm.
the little window in the back and the angel pointing towards her. You know, when you try to look somewhere else, it always like pushes you back
mm-hmm.
to the, especially the color difference, the lightness is not, because they don't use many colors to see the Renaissance.
I don't seem to be sort of just in the images in the one on the right, sort of three levels or something.
Mm-hmm.
You almost feel like there's an earthly level, a
mm-hmm.
cherubim, that's
yeah.
what they're called, and then the level
mm-hmm.
where you actually see what God, isn't that God that's depicted at the top?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So as I looked at that earlier today, I thought, I see three levels, whereas
mm-hmm.
with the first one, I see one level, and it does seem flat,
mm-hmm.
or flatter.
Mm-hmm. More things are going on, not just one.
Yeah.
You know, they show God, and the Holy Spirit, and cherubims, not just
mm-hmm.
Mary,
more action. Here we're focusing kind of on the main action, the central action, one topic, and one communicates that. And then the other one, a lot more is going on. And like you said, there are a lot more levels to it, too. And we have to, our eyes can't just stay on one part. We have to kind of look around and wander around and see how it all fits together. And this one is pretty clear and straightforward.
And this is just a question. With the Renaissance world, when we looked at it, the focal point, as they brought it in and showed you the spectrum as it came in, obviously, you know, you can look into that picture and see where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
When the Baroque era, was it different? I mean, because, like I said, we did in the class last semester, that he actually did a grid and a breakdown, like pulling the picture apart to know exactly where your eyes would be focusing on, whereas on the other
mm-hmm.
side, like I said, there's so much more going on. Would the focal point have shifted? I'm not talking about Mary, per se, but like the actual, I don't know the correct term for it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Vanishing point.
Mm-hmm.
Is it different from there?
I think that per se is not different. There's that is still the same. We just have a lot more depth here.
Okay.
And you have more like here you can see through, like really far through there.
Mm-hmm.
Here we don't really have that idea. But I think that the limb separation.
And also the faces, like there's more human emotion
mm-hmm.
like expressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to walk around. on one slide. A famous Swiss art historian, Boeslin, he was the first to actually discuss the Baroque as a style, as a movement separate from previous art historical periods. And he has, in this book, Principles of Art History from...
I'm sorry.
He discussed the differences between he didn't say the thing, but he was trying to think about the kind of world through Romanticism and classic and Renaissance art. And he distinguished them in those five central points that he discussed. So, according to him, classic or Renaissance art is primarily linear. That means it emphasizes line as a guide from behind. In the previous paper, we've seen there were these columns and a lot of vertical lines that are very important, that emphasize and classic art. And they give this image, this idea of stable solidity. Whereas in the painterly, he calls the Baroque the painterly style. Painterly style is, we have more of a, there are no clear lines, but forms merge and volumes are merge, everything looks a bit more blurry. And there's more of a shifting and moving quality. There are no stable, solid lines. And the paint, the quality of the paint is emphasized much more than the line. Then we have the plane as opposed to the recession. That just means that it's kind of creating, like in the previous picture, we had almost like a box-like stage where Mary and the Angel were moving. It was more like a, it was really almost like they were on a stage. Whereas with the painterly style, with the recession, there's more, it creates more of a depth. There are more levels to the picture, not just this plane where the main action takes place. And it's often created through the use of diagonals. So that's why those are very important. And those spatial relationships then create the impression of movement, of drama, even of mystery. Then we have the closed form versus the open form. That just means that those lines kind of define and enter the closed form, whereas in the painterly open form, since there are no clear lines, the form is kind of open. It goes everywhere and can even go out of the picture frame. Like we often actually have the impression that people or images in the picture are kind of bursting out of the picture, which never happens. Then we have the multiplicity versus unity. That means the multiplicity means just that every part in a classical picture is independent and could stand very well on its own. That doesn't mean that it lacks unity. It just means that the parts are so clear and self-contained that they could all stand on its own, on their own. Whereas in the painterly style, the effect is more the unity, the harmony of the unity as a whole. So the individual parts, they don't really make sense, or they don't really need to stand on their own. They need the whole to make, to create an effect. On their own, they maybe wouldn't create that same effect, but taken as a whole, so the painting is more interested in the effect as a whole, the painting as a whole creates. So we have more absolute clarity in the classical Renaissance art, and relative clarity in the painterly style. Relative clarity just means that the light and shadow play, so that nothing is really, not everything has to be completely clear. There are going to be some shady areas, some areas that you can't see at all because they're so dark. So clarity is not important, not the important aspect of those paintings. So that was his way of distinguishing these two art styles.
They're not very visible.
Okay. Well, this was supposed to be a map. I'm sure you can't see anything here. Okay, this was supposed to be a map of Holland in the 17th century, and as you cannot see here, there we had the Netherlands were divided into the Northern Netherlands and the Southern Netherlands, which are what we call Flanders, which is basically what today is.
Oh, Belgium.
So, Belgium was a Flanders and the Northern Netherlands were, is what, yeah, what we now call Holland. And there was, in the 17th century, there was developing a divide between the two. The north was basically Calvinist and Catholic. The south was governed by the Spanish king, so they were still Catholic and remained in the Catholic rule. So, maybe we could go to the next slide. This one doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Okay, so here doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Okay, so we have the northern the Netherlands were under the Habsburg dynasty, the Spanish king, the king was called the Habsburg, under Charles V in the 16th century. And Philip II of Spain attempted to conquer all of the Netherlands and make get rid of all of the Protestant movements, and he was very forcefully persecuted the Protestant religion and tried to unify everything under his government, and that led eventually led to revolt. So the Northern Netherlands revolted against his rule, and that led to the splitting up between the north and the south. And so the Northern Netherlands joined into the union of what was called the Union of Utrecht, and then the Roman Catholic, the South, the Flanders became the Union of Arras. And so this northern provinces eventually gained independence, and then under the Treaty of Münster, they were, which was also called the Treaty of Münster. They were granted independence from the south, but the war between France and the Netherlands went on for some 80 years. There was a wealthy truce in between, but they were basically at war for almost a century. So, so when they finally were able to create to get their independence and to stand on their own. The Northern Netherlands became incredibly successful, they just flourished culturally a lot, especially in terms of advanced science. They were incredibly important for trade throughout Europe. They had really enormous trade, and it was really a country of superlatives. They had 70,000 pictures painted per year, 110,000 lengths of cloth produced. The gross national income was 200 million guilders. They were the most urbanized. They had the highest rate of literacy. The general burgher, the general citizen, was very well-to-do. They had not a very high poverty rate. So they really were able to flourish quite a bit, and it's also often referred to as the Dutch Golden Age, just as in other countries at the time. It's kind of a cultural age of cultural flourishing. And they also were well in slave trade. They brought them a lot of money. And they had the way they were governed, it gave a lot of independence to the burghers and to the individual republic. So every merchant in town, or even every just a regular burgher, as they were called, middle class burghers were able to do fairly well through trade and other things. And so, because of their wealth, because of their high status, people liked to collect art or liked to have paintings painted. And so, the status of art changed during that time. There was no longer really so much demand of any religious art, because Calvinism is a non-iconic religion, so they forbade painting in church. But the market for religious painting was still pretty good, because other people now commissioned it. And there was a lot of portraits. So this was a great age of portrait painting, as well as still lifes or landscape paintings and which is what we're going to look at in a little bit. But art now became very important for really for the middle class. So it was not just a matter of the aristocracy collecting art, but really everybody liked to have art in their homes. It was kind of a much more democratic way of having or looking at art. Okay, so here we have another painting by Franz Hals. It was also often referred to as the art of describing as opposed to the art of rhetoric. So Dutch art in this time is interested in describing the life and time of the people. So it was often commissioned or created so that to the popular taste, not in order, not like in a grand historical scale, but more on a much smaller scale and directly geared at the public, at the general public. It's very a very peculiar kind of a very intense realism, but of course this realism is not it always appears kind of immediate, spontaneous, but of course it is very still very contrived. It should be called realism like this, because it's not like in this painting, if you look close at it, there are a lot of like brush strokes dashing around, so it looks like you just dash it off in the heat of the moment and within 5 minutes. But of course, studies have revealed that he took a very long time to paint each individual painting. It's kind of a contrived spontaneity, if you want to call it that. And this is called The Merry Drinker, and that was a very popular topic, drinking scenes. The Dutch were very happy drinkers, happy beer for drinking. So this was by no means like in earlier times he would have this as a, like a warning of temperance, allegory of temperance or something. Not so here. This is not by no means an allegory. This is the way they like to live, and we want to show that. So this was the kind of thing that they liked to display, because it was something about their own life.
Next one, please.
Okay, here we have the first two Vermeers, the domestic values. Okay, that was also another important topic. So this, like I already said, they liked to display pictures of their own homes, of their own domestic life. So now for the first time, really this, these domestic values became very important to display in art. Here, like on the left, we have the little street by Vermeer. This is almost like a photograph. You could just say somebody stood on the other side and photographed this painting here. But again, the studies have shown that this particular house, this particular scene doesn't really exist. So he obviously took something that he had seen, that he liked, that he observed, but then transformed it into his own imaginary view of the scene. So as realistic as the scene, it is not something that actually exists. It is a realism created in the painter's mind, so to speak. This other one, a young woman standing at a virginal. We will see a lot more paintings by Vermeer later on, but these images of domestic scenes became increasingly important too, not just by Vermeer, but by Vermeer as well. That is another indication of this idea of representing the middle class's values. So we have the woman, mother, probably a mother, housewife, making music, being inside a home. So the domestic scenes were primarily important to really represent their values, their value of the social structures too. They had kind of like built a leisure too. So the men brought the work, they were able to get the women, they didn't have to be at home to make music, they didn't have to work, they could make music and run it down the name. And we took care of everything. So it represented also the wealth of the middle class. So we were able to really enjoy life and didn't have to worry about cleaning the house or taking care of the children. We could come on one slide. I've talked about the still life. That became a very important genre too, because it represents what they had in their house. It represents their flowers, breakfast, decent food. And the Dutch were sort of world famous horticulturists. They had an important field trade, not until the stock market crash. it was a very important trait for them. So they liked flowers, and they were became among the best representative of flowers. Flower Peters is one of a female painter who specialized in the combination of flower and breakfast pieces. This is kind of a combination of flower breakfast piece with a pretzel there, dried fruit, and everything. This is kind of like a typical potato. The portrait is very carefully arranged, and that means it looks like. But these became very important for just for really for house decoration. They were among the best selling paintings, and people just let them have them in their house. So painters who specialized in flower paintings were among the best paid painters at that time. Okay, genre painting. What is the genre of painting?
Certainly, tragedy, comedy.
That is in literature. We have genre of that. Yeah, but that doesn't sound like art.
Kind.
It's kind of what it is. It represents a house scene or like a domestic scene. And here on the left, gosh, it's incredibly hot. My dog is, I can't really see.
Yes.
But here in this picture, we would see a woman who's probably just nursed her baby, is putting her baby back into the crib. And then in the background, there's another child walking off. So we have just a really typical domestic scene, mother and her children. One child plot playing, and like I've already said, this is a very important representation of family life, of house scenes. It's important that this is usually just for you have to get a scene moment. This is not a man's sphere. It was also now for the first time that mothers actually nursed their own babies. Before that, it was always somebody else. So now we have a new kind of a new family structure. The mother is a much more central figure, the mother and the children. Now, in the next painting here, we have the dissolute household. And if we could see that, we would see a lot of drinking going on. The husband is supposedly flirting with a maid. The housewife is drunk and laying on the table, can't see anything. The servants are running off from searching the drawers, the children are searching the mother's pockets, the dog is there, the monkey is stopping the clock. So this is kind of the reverse of what we have here. Here we have the orderly household, the mother is the house priestess, the housewife in the center as the figure of order, priestess, the center of it all. And in that painting, it's representing what happens when things go wrong, when there's no order. So this was also, this kind of painting was very popular because it was on the one hand very very entertaining to see, but on the other hand you could always say, well, this is like holding up and warning.
What would be the difference between the genre paintings and
domestic
value paintings?
The what?
You said there's like, they show domestic value to their genre. Is there a difference between those?
No, those could be considered.
Okay.
Yes. Genre painting is usually an indoor scene. That's one of the premier paintings out there before. The one with the street scene would probably be more of a, wouldn't really fall into that. But that's kind of the one with the indoor, yes. Are there any other questions you want?
All right, let's go on one slide here.
Okay, then we come to the third genre, the landscape painting. Here we have Jacob van Huisdael. He was probably one of the most famous landscape painters, Dutch landscape painters, and especially his windmills are very famous. That's also kind of the Dutch landscape. And here we have Vermeer's View of Delft, which we're also going to be discussing later on a bit more. Those became very important too because the Dutch they had a growing interest in their own landscape. They were very good about building dikes, and because the Netherlands are below sea level, so they had to be very crafty and dealing with that landscape in order to ensure that there was a sea level and not have flooding. So they were very proud of their own landscape and about how they cultivated the landscape. So that's something else that they liked to see. land. This is obviously a stone landscape, not a piece of landscape. Mm-hmm. Maybe also a little more mysterious. It's not really, again, not really a very realistic representation of a landscape. It's, I mean, the clouds are very dramatic. This is not really a typical Dutch sky that we have here. It's a very dramatic representation. It's much more imaginary. You would never say that this is likely to be a photograph with. Yeah, there's, you could almost say that almost photographic, but this is certainly anything but photographic. It's much more mysterious, much more romantic in a way, much more imaginary. So this is a very different approach to nature painting we have here. All right, that brings us to our first hero. Rembrandt. Okay, here we have a map. That's good. Okay, so Rembrandt, he was from Leiden, which is not too far away from Amsterdam, which is where he moved later on. And so Belgium, this is what would have been the Flemish part of
Netherlands. So here, this is the Protestant?
Yeah, this is all of this. So both Rembrandt and Vermeer are from the Protestant Calvinist, Catholic part. Flemish painters are really very different. Maybe some of you know Rubens? This is really not comparable at all. And it's just a very different style, much more influenced by the Italian Renaissance and
Caravaggio.
Yeah. Well, I'm influenced by Caravaggio too, because Caravaggio is the one who started the school. So, but it is a very different. I mean, just the art developed very differently in those two parts. Okay. So his work is often separate into four periods. Now, if I'm going to be talking about these four periods, but we still have to bear in mind that this is really not a clear-cut development. Like with any artist or writer, we never really have clear-cut periods. There are overlaps, and Rembrandt worked in many different mediums, not just paint. He drew, he did etching, and there are overlaps, and what a development in one medium isn't necessarily paralleled by the same development in a different medium. So this is really just a broad orientation, because his life spans such a large, I mean, his earth is so incredibly large, which is helpful to talk about too, but it's really just helpful. It's not, as if it's not cut in stone. So, move to the first one. So he started out in Leiden, his native town, and this is actually his very first known painting, and he's been over there, so this is the first known one, the Stoning of Christine. And he actually started out with history paintings right away, because he apparently wanted to. This was one of the most important journals, and he wanted to make himself known in that journal from the outset. Now, so this is the Stoning of St. Stephen. And we can see some of the immaturity here. The organization is not as well done as in later paintings. But what is also interesting for is this is actually one of the very first self-portrait, and this is the painting that was probably the most self-portraits ever, and you've looked at some of them. But, of course, you can't see that here, but underneath this arm, so here we can see his first representation of himself. So he's from the first, now that he's been very different to the other ones. Let's okay, so here we have one of his first real self-portraits. He didn't do self-portraits because he was very vain and liked himself, but primarily for the purpose of studying. He was the cheapest model that he could find. So he used himself primarily to study chiaroscuro effects on the face and facial expressions. He has a lot of drawings with different facial expressions, laughing, self-laughing, self-portrait smiling, self-portrait grinning, self-portrait, I mean, just different sort of frowning, just different facial expressions. And that was facial expression was something that he really liked to study and to try out. Now, this is also very kind of a barren self-portrait because it totally rejects earlier self-portraiture. You would never have a self-portrait, a self-portrait where you can't see the eyes. That would be just totally unheard of. So having a self-portrait but then making your half of your face, having half of your face in the shade and not being able to see the eyes, that was something really, really unheard of and gets him this kind of a mysterious quality. Okay, here we have St. Paul at his writing desk, and I was going to ask you a couple of questions about it, but since you can't see anything, I will refrain. So like I already said, he was very interested in historical and religious paintings from the beginning. His interest in religious paintings deepened as he moved on in his mature period. Most of his paintings are on religious topics. And here we have a very early attempt at using chiaroscuro and playing with different light and shade and with colors to the landscape. Okay, so we're here in the first Amsterdam period. So we, when you was how old was he about then? In 1632, you moved to Amsterdam, and that was a very important step in his career because Amsterdam was kind of the cultural center. And he came into contact with many important people there, and he almost immediately acquired a great reputation, became famous, and was very sought after. People remembered his portrait and so on. So this was an important period in his life. And this is also when he started signing his paintings only with his first name, like other famous painters have done. So he's stepping into the footsteps of the giants before him and kind of adopting the same thing. And yeah, like I said later on, other people like that too. All the professors and staff name, but Van Gogh, for example, didn't. So, and this is also in Amsterdam, he also met his wife, Saskia, when he married. And this is also where he discovered the art of this Flemish painter Rubens that I mentioned. And his chiaroscuro, there are some influences of Rubens. Rubens was a very famous, in not just in the Flemish part of the Netherlands, but also the internationally well-known at the time when he began painting. So he was an important influence. Now, we can see this a little better. What can you tell me about this painting? Yeah, we have a corpse here and a being dissected. So this is Lesnar's, this doctor who's dissecting the forearm of this corpse and there's also a pair of these pupils. And of course, all the light is on that corpse and the corpse and on the. Again, kind of a bit of a gruesome scene where we see slowly seeing all the blood there. And
was this a new thing at this period then, the emergence of. So much, we've learned a lot about science, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And was this a new thing then for this time period to have
opposed to stonings and beatings and things like that? Where was science becoming more a more common theme in paintings?
It comes in with the Renaissance, and they're doing it in the 16th century, certainly.
I mean,
oh, but there's a great deal of resistance to it as well. So it's kind of a dark art.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes along with the Renaissance impulse for inventorying everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do that too, and eventually I imagine it's catching on more in the 17th century.
Yeah. I mean, with Leonardo da Vinci, we have a lot of anatomical paintings, but nothing about a section of an actual body. Much more, just more, more like the just the body, but not the open body.
So the purpose was more the spectacle element, maybe.
That is more important, yeah. But the spectacle, but the spectacle, but also and the reaction to it. I think that is the important part because we also have a lot of light on the faces and the different facial reactions to it, which we really can't see or don't.
And in the corpse, it's like his self-portrait. You don't see the eyes. So
yeah.
It's taking the human element away from
mm-hmm.
the
and that in
corpse.
A way is, yeah. And that in a way is much less important than his arm as being the sector.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Could that, taking away the even, what Wings is talking about, dissection, I don't know, even mind one here, when you cover the eyes and he said takes the human element away, this kind of goes back to Descartes, maybe separating body and soul, mind
mm-hmm.
and body, and that, you know, really the only, you know, because after Descartes, certain
Here we can see him. We still have very careful on the kind of light and shade. He's very elegantly dressed. We can see that he's very well in his fur coat. And he's looking straight at us. And he has a fairly stern, self-confident, maybe even defiant look. But he's definitely very much more
debonair,
yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. He's definitely kind of maybe even a little bit. Yeah, a little bit arrogant in a way. Mm-hmm. And we see in the background there the shadow and also on the back wall the shadow is shadow plays important and interesting for him. Okay, here we have another religious painting, the Holy Family. This is one of the paintings that shows his the influence of Rubens. Just like the Landing of Sandman that we looked at before. This is a very large painting, and it's one of the things from the blue with this really large scale history painting. And here we have a little less, I mean, we still have the Thomas Kuhler in the back, but we have the Holy Family is totally in the light of the main characters, are all totally illuminated, therefore just the light and shadow in the background, but not really, especially the two main. Not so much. The character effect is not quite as central here as in the other ones. All right. How are we doing this time? I still have some time right before the break.
Sorry?
Do I have some time before the
oh,
break?
Oh, sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Okay, great. All right, then we're moving on to, again, to the Night Watch. Okay, this is not the first thing of his middle, but we're now moving on to his middle period, which is kind of his central period of his work. And kind of the represents kind of the high baroque style, and which later on then decreases. So this is a more high baroque art. And during this period, there are also increasingly more classicistic elements. So this is kind of the movement from this very high baroque, flamboyant baroque art later on to an increasingly less or more of a side-by-side of Baroque elements and classicistic elements. This is also the period where he's becoming increasingly less popular and increasingly more introspective. His work is becoming more, not just his self-portraits, they're becoming more introspective, but also his other work. It seems like he's much getting, becoming more interested in the mysterious and the soul. There's also increasingly more religious interest, and he is, well, one of the his external circumstances of the change. His wife died in exactly that year, in 1642. And there, people often say, or it's often a romantic interpretation of him, often say that this painting kind of brought his ruin, that he was, that he painted this and became immediately unpopular. And there's a big myth about him just losing favor, and everybody then just doesn't like him anymore, and he becomes poor and dies poor, and just dies at the banker. It is true that he did lose some of his patrons. It is true that he wasn't quite as wealthy and rich anymore, but he didn't fall totally into poverty, and that's just been way exaggerated. And this painting certainly didn't cost. This painting was well paid for it, and he continued to receive commissions for portraits, for group portraits. That was kind of a romantic biography. There was definitely a shift in appreciation, which is on the one hand due to probably a shift in taste. People just there's another Flemish painter, Anthony van Dyck. I'm not sure if you've heard of him, but his paintings will be becoming increasingly popular, and it's, and just like Woman's, it's a very different style. So people just changed their taste, and he didn't fit into it. His paintings were getting a little too dark. People were just not really into this, this dark painting anymore, and also maybe his introspective mode. Maybe that also didn't quite match people's taste, but nevertheless, he didn't really fall out of favor. So this is a total myth. Now, this painting is often considered like his most famous one, not just because of this myth, but I think it has a lot to do with it. That this painting is often described as bringing his downfall. Now, there are a ton of films about him, and almost every single one makes this before. He paints this painting, people look at it and just go, oh my god, we don't like this, and then he falls out of favor with them. I was going to show you one film clip, and you can see that before them. Great. And there's just a very recent one by Peter Greenaway, I don't know if you're an English filmmaker. He makes a lot of films about art and artists. He has a couple of films also there, the museum is playing an important role. But this painting is called Night Watching. And it is a new interpretation of the painting, and he uses this painting to say that Rembrandt was discovering a murder plot. So that this painting actually conceals the murder plot, and that he used this painting to accuse the officers of the murder plot, and that therefore he was rejected, and that therefore people didn't like him anymore, and that this was the reason for his big downfall. So, I mean, this is an ongoing thing. People feel like they use this painting to show all sorts of things about him. It's an interesting film. It's not a bad film at all. It's an interesting interpretation, but it's, of course, not really based on story or facts. But the film clip that I was going to show you... Can you do that?
Yes. I will need to get out of this eventually.
That's okay. Okay, this film is by Alexander Korda, who was a British filmmaker. The film is from 1936, so very early. It's in black and white, and called Rembrandt. And it's about his life, and it kind of uses the painting as a focal turning point. And I just wanted to show you a little bit of the beginning, and then the scene, and then my work is revealed. And let's just pay attention to how this represents.
Which scene do you want to...
Let's just start with the beginning. Maybe we can pass
beginning?
Yeah.
I should think we could do that. What's the menu, though?
And then we'll skip to scene 3.
Something's happening.
That's good.
Menu's on the left of the wheel. So you have far left, right by the... Yeah, right.
That will give the menu. Well, It seems to be... What are you doing? Just what they have in here.
Maybe X.
I don't know what's going on here. We seem to be playing fine. Heavens. It doesn't seem to want to do anything. I may have to.
And maybe if you can select, I don't know what programs you have on there, but maybe you can maybe play.
What format is this in? It's just a regular DVD.
Normally the
DVD player in here should be fine. You seem to be wanting to give me trouble. Ho-ho-ho.
We could take a break while you...
They could take a break.
That's a good idea, yeah. Let's do that.
How long?
15 minutes.
20 minutes, if that's... Yeah, if
yep.
That probably would be the only one, yeah.
Yep.
But then we can work out these problems. Yes. Yes, I agree.
But you played, obviously, you played Friends
on this. Oh, that's not going to be a problem. No. It will not be a problem, I assure you. I promise you. It will not be a problem. I don't know what's going on in this case. But I'm sure.
Have you never had other PowerPoints? Have you had the slide to do a presentation before?
I believe that Elizabeth Dizot did it. She used it. And it wasn't great. It wasn't as bad as this. I don't know why we're not able to adjust the brightness. That is bad. Now, if you're willing, we can put this up on blackboard.
Well, I don't have to click on
that. No. I'm not talking about the
PowerPoint.
PowerPoint.
Yes, of course.
That we can do. Yeah. But, of course, after the fact. So here it is. Why I need to check everything before several times. But when I came in here earlier, somebody was showing a film, which they were was not scheduled. So I don't know what was going there.
Okay, for my paper topic, I was thinking I have trouble picking topics when I get a big area. But anyway,
it's a big area.
I was thinking of using the Battle for Novo and the Sack of Rome by Charles V.
Oh, how interesting.
The end of the beginning of the Baroque.
Okay.
Possible.
I don't see. Yeah, that seems fine to me. Okay. I'm going to keep it small for right now. So what's going on with you, mister? What's
me?
Going on? I'm sorry, not you.
Oh.
No, I'm talking to the computer in the usual way. So what are we seeing here? This doesn't look like a menu, exactly.
If you could go, yeah.
Not permitted. I can't go to the menu. Now, if I do play, that's where we ran into problems.
Yeah.
Okay, this seems better. This is better. We're getting a better response. That's just the intro thing.
Maybe
okay.
We can just let it play, and then I'll just tell you what it's done.
Okay.
Oh, no, here we go.
Well, here, this is more like it. Do we want subtitles?
It is in English, so.
Oh, French. Or Spanish.
Sure.
Okay, well, it's up to you. Up to you. We may not be able to see the very well. Oh, it's nice black and white. Very fine. Yes. Okay. I just turned the sound off. Gertrude Lawrence, of course, Elsa Manchester. from the film play. Yes, yes. Wasn't there an Alexander Korda as well?
That's him. That's exactly him.
But it said Vincent. I thought it said with a different name.
That was, okay, Alexander Korda is the director. Vincent Korda was, I think, the...
Oh, the something else.
The,
oh, okay.
Something special effects or something.
Okay. Where's this recording? How fine. And the year of this is...
It's 36.
Okay. The fine year. Okay, so we're just going on. And on and on.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fine. And Brent's brother, peasant lad. Second peasant lad.
Okay, here we start.
Right there?
And now we do have French.
Well, we'll get rid of it, sorry, because I don't think you want them to be.
And
those sometimes I'm going to use subtitles. Spanish off. Okay. So just right there?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll make it big. And the sound is fine, so that's not a problem.
So?
Okay. I'm going to try. So what are our other outstanding problems? So just the brightness.
Just
the blasted brightness.
I can do
this. It works for other things. And look, that...
Do you want to stop
that
the
laser
recording
pointer. Pardon?
Do you want to stop the recording while I'm playing?
Oh. I'll probably forget. I might forget to turn it back on again.
Yeah.
Although, well, I guess I can stop it. But I'm not sure how to stop it. I'm just going to turn it off.